In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Hello and welcome to In the Thick of It, our weekly podcast where Colin Lambert, Managing Editor of Profit and Loss, and myself, Galen Stobbs, Editor of Profit and Loss, have a little discussion and give our take on the news of the week. So to kick us off, Colin, I wanted to start off talking about the news of a whistleblower that I was reading about at Royal Bank of Canada. So he was today found by a London tribunal to have been unfairly dismissed. I know you've been taking a look at this. What are your thoughts on this case?
It's an interesting one because it's not often that you see things in a legal document referring to a particularly odious person and nasty character. But it's quite an interesting judgment. It's available. I read through it this morning. And so basically what happened was John Banerjee at RBC was dismissed allegedly for his poor timekeeping. However, he claimed unfair dismissal because he'd raised issues around the compliance procedures at the bank. Also, the fact that he felt traders weren't attesting properly to their global FX compliance documents, and brilliantly, he also claimed he was offered a bribe by his manager. Now that basically involved a loss in somebody missed a stop loss order in Hong Kong, or a call level, and involved a Zimbabwean. I don't even know what the Zimbabwean currency is, but either way, he was trading in Zimbabwe. And he missed a thing, and there was a conversation with Ed Monahan, who was global head of foreign exchange, or maybe global head of FIC at RBC at the time. And in this conversation, Monahan said, "Look, is it a loss you're worried about? I'll cut you a check." Now, this was perceived to be a bribe. The judge totally dismisses that because clearly, as anyone, most people in dealing rooms know, what he was saying was, "Look, if the loss is worrying you and it was a genuine mistake, we'll put the loss somewhere else." When I used to trade, we would have a book put aside for errors because we don't see why a trader should be penalised for someone else's error. So I kind of get that aspect of it. So the whole thing was pretty sensationalist, and he was claiming whistleblower status. Now, as I understand it,
he didn't hire any solicitors himself because he was worried that the high cost would leave him, this quote I saw was homeless. So he's supported by Whistleblowers UK, a non-profit, right?
Yeah. And it's good that we have organisations like this because, let's face it, one thing the judge pointed out was the number of documents and pages involved in this thing. There was something like 6,600 pages of evidence produced, all produced by lawyers, of course, respondent side, all of which cost a lot of money. Once again, we see the legal industry getting very rich at the foreign exchange industry's cost. So he claimed whistleblower status. Now, in the judgment, it says that the whistleblower element was withdrawn sometime in August last year. But the case obviously continues. So I don't think he's actually getting whistleblower status, which would enable him to sue the bank for untold amounts of money. Instead, he could be subject to the usual £78,000. What I would say, of course, is as with all of these dealers, I've spoken to one or two guys that have been dismissed, and it's not about the money. It's about the fact that, by being unfairly dismissed, they can be employable again. What I find fascinating with this one was there's no doubt that he had problems with his timekeeping. The thing logs at least 30 occasions over the course of like 9 months when he was late, sometimes by 45 minutes to an hour, not just 10 minutes. And he's reminded of it constantly by his manager and apologises every time. And then obviously just falls back into bad ways. So you look at it on face value and think, well, yeah, of course he would have been done for that because there's so many occasions. But what was interesting was the judge suddenly turned around and said, well, actually, the senior manager, Ed Monahan, only got involved after the guy started making noise. And he does seem to be – the judge mentions how aggressive he is in raising his concerns about the compliance procedures and lack of breach. And it's only then that they turned around and said, okay, well, no, let's get rid of the guy. And the judge has found for him. Now, we're not here to comment upon the judge's decision. But I must confess, the first time I actually thought, in the whole reading the whole document, the first time I thought that he would maybe win his case was when the judge actually said, and I find in favour of the claimant, because I'm reading through the rest of it going like, I'm not sure it's a great advert for the guy's future employment prospects, shall we say.
Yeah.
On a broader note, he did make, I mean, he makes a lot of relevant points, don't get me wrong, but on a broader point, compliance, is this, I mean, is it becoming so complex? Because it says RBC set aside 30 minutes for people to read the global ethics policy document. Now, it seems to be quite accepted by all parties here that it takes at least an hour. So you're taking a trader off the desk for an hour to read through a compliance document. We've made, if you take the model code, ACI's model code has been a precursor of the global code. The model code is incredibly detailed and great piece of work, but really hard to work through sometimes because it was just so many pages of it. It literally was a book. The FX Global Code, I think it's 49 pages. We've made the principles easier. Do we need to make compliance easier? Because it strikes me that if you're trying to read through compliance stuff where lawyers have been involved and it's more and more pages involved, you're going to miss something. You're bound to. Or you're going to have to read through it three or four times to make sure you get it. So do you think we need to actually sort of turn around now and say compliance needs to follow or go against the grain and actually become a little bit more simpler? Let's just get the main points out there.
Potentially. I think it's also a problem that this is, I've seen to a friend of mine. This was, I guess, maybe a year and a half ago now. And this guy wasn't especially senior, you know, on a derivatives desk, but, like, you know, he was moving upwards. But he was honestly looking to get out of a bank, specifically because they said to me, look, I get a stack of papers on my desk every day, and it's all this stuff that I've got to sign off on. And I've not actually had that much compliance training. I don't really know. A lot of the time, I just have to sign this stuff. I get a whole stack of papers. I've got to sign it. And I'm really nervous that a couple of years down the line, someone's going to come back at me and I'm going to get in trouble because they're going to hold up a sheet of paper that has my name scribbled on it somewhere for something that I really wasn't really trained or equipped to know the compliance ins and outs of what I was signing. I think that's a bit of a problem, which is bank staff don't necessarily have the legal and compliance understanding to know what they should be doing in that kind of situation.
Well, to go back to one of our previous podcasts when you were talking about the number of compliance people in the bank. I mean, and I think I mentioned at the time that there was a whole building at one bank that actually was meant to be taking on 4,000 or 5,000 people, including all the traders, and it ended up being all 4,000 or 5,000 people compliance. Clearly, there's a shedload of people out there doing this stuff. The other point he raised, what I thought was quite interesting, is it's all very well doing these compliance documents, and they were written. This policy was written for G10 markets, which obviously is the majority of their market. But he said, as an emerging market trader, it's nigh on impossible to fulfil some of those compliance requests. So, on one hand, I suppose this is the challenge we've got. On one hand, I'm saying we've got to make compliance so much more simpler. But on the other hand, you've got this guy saying, well, actually, it's way too generic because he doesn't take into account, I mean, honestly, how the hell do you trade Zimbabwe? It's beyond my comprehension. But
right,
there clearly would be differences there. So maybe we've got to have a more targeted compliance regime. Don't know.
On a slightly lighter note, do you know what I do enjoy? So I go to the Futures Industry Association conference in Boca in Florida every year. And, you know, they've got all these booths where, you know, the vendors and various sponsors are kind of, you know, selling their wares or whatever. But every year the CFTC has a whistleblower booth. They set up these booths, and they put, like, a load of whistles all over the table. And, like, I was standing there once, with, like, doing an interview with a hedge fund person. And the hedge fund guy looks at me, and he just spots the table. He looks at me and goes, is that for real? And I was like, yeah. And he's just like, God, that's got to be bloody awkward. If you're just, like, you're just hanging around, you see one of your colleagues go up to the whistleblower table and just, like, sit down in the booth and start chatting to the CFTC. He's like,
it's hardly protecting the whistleblower status. Yeah. Yeah. So he's going to go up there and, like, you know, take one of the whistles off the table and stop blowing it at the CFTC or something.
Especially if it's after a cocktail party when right, people are getting a bit looser.
It's like, I get the idea, but it's like, it seems a little bit ridiculous to have a whistleblower booth.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they should just put, you know, wads of cash on there, because that's what they seem to be doing now. I mean, they've awarded three whistleblower rewards over the last couple of weeks, haven't they, the CFTC, including the first offshore award. So maybe they should get rid of the whistles and just stick down, you know, $1,000 bills or something.
I know, the kind of money they've been throwing around, I wish I had someone to blow the whistle, frankly.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm here, mate. I'm happy to share. Just tell me what I need to do. Unfortunately, I don't think we can do anything quite serious enough. But, you know, we can consider it. Yeah. So something you mentioned something. You mentioned the things coming back to haunt you, which brings me to another thing this week, the case of Jitesh Thacker from Edge Technologies.
Yeah, and so much so, Lo, to give you credit, I enjoyed your column today. And it really got me thinking. I mean, I haven't read the actual case files myself, so I don't want to comment too much on the Thacker case.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is the point about the precedent it could set, you know, regardless of guilt, the precedent it could set if there is a conviction of some sort, in terms of what it means for technology firms providing technology for something illicit that then happens down the line. And I think it's interesting, particularly as we get to an age where, like, you know, everybody gets very excited about kind of all the fintech trend. And there's this trend towards, like, outsourcing, right? If you set up a hedge fund today, right, I can outsource, like, the technology, the operations, like, lots of my HR stuff. You know, I can like, outsource pretty much everything bar, like, the actual trading itself, right?
Mm.
And so then what happens, and this might be a bad example if I stop and think about it more, but the first thing that springs to my mind is, you know, if a technology provider sold someone, you know, an algo suite, someone uses one of those algos, and it goes haywire and causes huge disruption in the market, I'm thinking, you know, full chaos, full flash crash, whatever, right? You know, if regulators came in and wanted to know what happened, the trading firm could potentially point to the algo provider and say, hey, they sold me these algos. I looked at it. It all looked fine. But you know, there was obviously something wrong with the code and it went crazy. Then the algo provider could equally turn around and say, hey, you know, these are absolutely fine. Here, take a look at the code. This was used in either in an incorrect way or was used in a way that we hadn't envisaged it would be used. And then who's really the responsible party there as you look at it from kind of a regulatory standpoint?
Well, basically what happens is the lawyers get rich again because we're back in the world of he said, she said.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, to my mind, I find it an interesting one because, you know, I use the sort of the example of the US gun lobby. I mean, I was going to reference Charlton Heston in my column, which will be a first. But I always remember Charlton Heston saying every time someone goes in and shoots a bunch of people, he goes, "Oh no, you know, you can't blame you know the gun laws or the manufacturers of these things. You've got to blame the guys you know who's got it in his hands." And yeah, there's an argument for that, I suppose. But this seems to be going the other way. They're saying, "Well, actually, no. You know what? You provided technology, and therefore it was used for nefarious purposes. Therefore, you're bang in line." I think in this case it's an interesting. I've read through his motion to dismiss and the government's response. It's quite a tricky one because I think you know it's quite technically legal, which is obviously way beyond me. But I think it's this back of book function. I look at it and think, well, as a trader, someone said to me, I want to be at stage four of the book on a public market, and I never want to be top of book. I only want to be stage four. And if someone comes in and sort of, or if orders disappear, then I want to add another lot to my order so I can move back to back of book. Who trades? Who puts orders into a market that doesn't want to trade? As a trader, I find that totally illogical. The thing is, of course, is that
if I'm talking to some web programmer who's never been near a market in their life, they could turn around and say, okay, there must be a reason for it. That's what he wants. Customer's always right. Code's away. And what they're actually doing is helping the guy to break the law. So it comes down to this question of, like, you know, what knowledge of the market do they have? And I honestly do believe that if you're these fintech firms are going to have a choice of two things. They're either going to have to really seriously ramp up their compliance burden, going back to our first point, which means that they become overwhelmed and probably can't operate as, you know, what's their edge? Their edge is they're nimble and they're quick. If you've got a compliance burden or you've got a lawyer involved somewhere, guess what? Everything grinds to a, you know, to a halt pretty quickly. So the fintech model then becomes challenged, to my mind. On the other hand, I do see the government's point because, you know, Jitesh Thacker sat on the CFTC Technical Advisory Committee on high-frequency trading. So that, to me, suggests that there's some knowledge of what's going on in the market.
I don't know what the burden of proof is in a case like this. I should probably find that out. Because is it a case that, you know, they need, like, a statement or, you know, a video of him holding that day's paper saying, I know exactly what spoofing is, here's how it works, and here's how you're designing something for it? Or does it just need to be, you know, to the point where it logically follows that he knew what he was doing? I don't know how explicit it has to be. Because it's difficult to prove what someone knew.
It is, and I think that's the key to it. And also, Navinda Sarayo, like the Hound of Hounslow, in the motion to dismiss documents, he says he told federal investigators that he did not share his reasons for wanting the back-of-book functionality or the program designed the way it was with Jitesh Thacker. So, you know, he didn't tell him what it was for, apparently, because in typical Hound of Hounslow style, he didn't tell him because he didn't want him to know how much money he'd be making out of it, because then he'd charge him a bit more. And the guy was making 25 million. The guy's making 25 million bucks out of spoofing, and he was worried about paying another 12 grand to some bloke for a programming thing. Go figure. So yeah, I mean that would be an interesting one. I think, you know, it's I'm not sure where the sort of judge or the appeals process goes with that. That would be worth watching. But if I was a fintech, or if even I was a programmer at an institution, I would be making doubly sure that I pay attention to that case, because to me it could have serious implications. But yeah, could be wrong again. That brings me to something else, actually, because if I look at this idea of technology going rogue, where do you think we sit in the world of AI and machine learning, whereby somebody can build a basic program with inputs and then just leave the computer to go regenerate? Say years ago, I spoke to the guys at Harvard University who were genetically breeding foreign exchange trading programs. It took the Harvard supercomputer 3 hours to work out that one bank update is slower than another bank, therefore we had latency arbitrage. That was a surefire way to make money. So how do we sort of blend this in with the AI world, whereby someone could turn around and go, okay, well, you know, here's our basic program, here's our inputs, we're going to give it to you, and you're going to apply AI and machine learning techniques to it and let it run. Supposing that goes rogue.
Yeah, so I actually think – so we've put a couple of pieces out on AI this week, and I've been talking to some hedge funds, the Trade FX specifically, that use AI to kind of build strategies and deploy strategies. I think in some ways that element is like – that concern is slightly overblown. If there's one thing I've kind of been learning from the articles I've been doing on AI lately, it's how much human interaction – human involvement and human work is still involved in AI as it exists today.
Yeah.
We did a video interview that came out on Monday with Andrei Rusakov from Data Capital Management, which is a hedge fund that uses its strategies all built off AI. And he was kind of arguing the key thing is this interaction between man and machine, and that AI really does is puts kind of, as he put it, human ingenuity on steroids, right? It just allows you to accentuate your own kind of understanding of the markets with this huge data set. We also we had a panel on the New York conference where a lot of the guys talked about the limitations of AI in finance. I think lots of people have this idea that AI, when it comes to trading, it's just this big black box that you throw a load of data yeah. in and it starts spitting out strategies and it runs off trading, etc. But that's really not the case. And they talked about sort of a lot of the limitations, how not that many people in AI are like actually doing it. As one person put it, if you can't solve a problem, don't ask a machine to solve it. And definitely don't ask a machine to solve it by throwing tons of data at it. Right. Mm. I mean, most of the problems that we're getting AI to solve right now, they're things that we can do. It's just we're using it to do it more efficiently and quicker. And one hedge fund I was talking to today, he literally walked me through the process of everything they do to collect the data, to clean the data, to go through the data, to then like use it in an actionable way. He was talking about all the human interactions that's needed. And he was like, honestly, it's exhausting. He was like, it's like a shale oil production thing. He's like, we've got a whole team of people working to produce this stuff. It's not as easy or simple or straightforward as it sounds. And so that's why when I hear about kind of, is it going to be a problem when we have, more AI interaction in the market, in this kind of fintech regulatory kind of perspective. I mean, maybe when we get to like, at the moment, the few people who are really doing AI, they're doing like supervised machine learning. Maybe if we get to like unsupervised machine learning, which I really haven't heard of anyone really doing in trading at the moment. Maybe if we get to that stage, it will be more of a concern, but I think we're pretty far away from that moment in time right now.
I think if you have unsupervised trading in AI, or if we don't have that human interaction element in AI, then the strategy as a trading strategy is bound to fail. Because, that's a pretty big statement, I know, but the thing is, ultimately, without the nuances of the human brain, intellect and psychology, the AI machines will be crunching pretty much the same data, particularly in public markets, and they will all end up with the same idea. And so what you'll do, you'll get a mad rush into a position, and then you'll get a mad rush out of it, and only the fastest will actually make money. And generally speaking, by the fastest, I mean probably the fastest 5 or 6 out of 1,000. The others will literally just disappear. Equally, as a trader, if you're sitting there and you're aware of what these techniques are looking at, and you actually have an AI strategy yourself, but you don't trade it, that can then become your counterindicator. And believe me, I know what I'm talking about when it comes to being a counterindicator. Just look at me over the World Cup and this week on Bitcoin. But you have the wherewithal there to turn and say, like, okay, here's all the data. My AI program's the same as everyone else's because it's unsupervised. It's telling me to buy Apple. Great. Let them all buy Apple. Then I'm going to go in and I'm going to sell it quite aggressively. And the AI machines are all going to pick up on the same thing, and they're going to turn around and sell the shit out of it. And if they do that, guess what? I'm going to make a shed load of money. So to my mind, I think, the human interaction in AI is going to be vitally important, because otherwise we end up with too many crowded trades, a big swinging market, but with plenty of opportunities for non-AI people. And of course, we all know about investors. They'll follow the money. If the AI funds are making money, they'll go there. But if they're not, if they find someone else that's actually anti-AI and making money, that's where they'll push their money. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. I totally take your point about the human interactions. I think that's something you're quite right. It's something that is overlooked too much. So,
and frankly, I think by the time we get to unsupervised AI trading market, I reckon that by that point, Skynet's already taken over and we've got bigger things to worry about.
Yeah, that's a fair point, actually. Yeah, and I saw Arnie on Twitter this week going on about Trump. Wasn't quite sure. He looked a bit Jean-Claude Juncker to me, which is in the euphemism for maybe having had a few cold ones. but yeah, there'll be no Arnie to save us next time either. So yeah. One other thing I just wanted to briefly touch on this week was. and I'm not sure it's important or not. It could just be the quirk of the calendar. But I don't think I've ever seen so much come through my desk about moving away from LIBOR and onto these risk-free rates. There's initiatives in the US, in Europe, in Switzerland, in the UK. There's been one in Australia. Everywhere seems to be looking at this thing, and they've all come at once. And I'm just maybe just, you know, asking the question of the audience rather than of us. But are we in danger of, like, something going wrong with this move away from LIBOR? Because I get the big problem is, of course, is that you've got people, you know, they can index to overnight index swaps. They can benchmark to overnight index swaps. But from my perspective, I'm sitting there like, you're going to Sonia, you're going to SOFR. These are overnight rates. And you've got people who need to benchmark 3, 6, and 12-month transactions against 3, 6, 12-month rates. You can't benchmark them against an overnight Sonia rate. It just there's no logic to it. So are we sort of in danger of missing? Is this why we're suddenly seeing the authorities go, we need to come up with an alternative, we've got to get term risk-free rates going? I wonder if we're going to end up with a bit more regulation, because we could. At the moment, the problem is there's no liquidity in these longer-term contracts. And so you end up, I mean, brilliantly, there was a thing in the Bank of England working paper this week that said, oh, another alternative for a data source is indicative rates. And I'm thinking, indicative rates, that's exactly what LIBOR was. So we're going straight back to the original problem with LIBOR. So one of your solutions to getting rid of LIBOR is to have indicative rates, which are submitted
LIBOR
by people.
LIBOR 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah, they're submitted by people sitting on trading desks about where they think the market is. Let me have a think. Well, nothing could go wrong there. I mean, it worked perfectly well last time. So
we'll call it Robel.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's something going on there, and I can't work out. It could just be that it's just a quirk of the calendar, and everyone says, look, we've got to get this work going, and they're all globally coordinating it. And I know the FSB in Basel, you know, put a statement out about it last week. But I'm just looking at this thing thinking they do sound a bit desperate about the lack of liquidity in the medium-term contracts. So, you know, it might be something to keep an eye on. And if any listeners have got any real insight into that, because clearly I'm blagging here, being an old spot trader, then if they got any real insight into this, then please drop me a line, because I think it might be something that's, you know, worth covering in more detail. So we'll come back to that one. I thought what we close out this week, then, mate, is we've published our Chicago program, which is the event that, you know, I know everyone at P&L looks forward to greatly every year. I'm not sure my liver does, but the rest of me does. We've published our Chicago agenda this week, and I thought we'll go into it in more detail in coming weeks in the podcast, particularly as we get nearer the time. But I thought we'd sort of just jump in first. So we've got something like 10 to 12 panels, I think it is, plus individual sessions. 11 panels plus individual sessions. What one are you looking forward to the most?
Well, firstly, one of the ones I'm most looking forward to is actually the debate we've got. For those of you who haven't seen it online, the P&L debate this year, the motion is pre-hedging is front-running. I am very keen to see who ends up taking up the gauntlet on that one. That is, to say the least, a controversial topic. If you're interested,
I still want to do it.
Email Colin or myself.
Yeah.
Because we, yeah, that's going to be good, I think. There could be fireworks on that one.
I want to do that one, mate. I really want to get involved in that one. I'll argue with myself on that one.
Well, maybe we'll have to spread it out and have a two-person sort of tag team affair.
Yeah.
the other one, I mean, yeah, with the self-serving caveat, they're all wonderful panels. The other thing that jumped out at me was, I know, I'm kind of interested in the FX supermarkets one. I'm very interested in kind of the M&A activity we've seen so far. I'm very interested to see what the exchanges end up doing with the OTC platforms they bought. And I'm interested to hear people's thoughts on why this trend is good and why it's bad. I mean, I had one conversation with
the HFT non-bank market maker, they're somewhere in that bracket. So I had a conversation with one of those firms recently, and you know, they were pretty candid in saying that they thought that this trend, this sort of supermarket that everyone's trying to build, is fantastic news for them personally. But they could equally see, from other people's perspectives, there were quite a lot of big downsides. And so they were saying, when I was saying, oh, we're going to have a panel on that in Chicago, they were saying, oh, they can't wait to hear kind of the arguments on both sides and hear that kind of teased out and discussed yeah. more, kind of the pros and cons of this model, not just for the people trying to build it, but also for kind of the market more broadly. So that's one that I'm definitely interested in, given kind of the M&A activity, and I've been kind of doing quite a lot of the reporting on that. So that's one area that's kind of got me excited. What about you?
Yeah. I'm going to be a little bit more old-fashioned, sure. Old and new fair. I'm putting my trader's hat back on again. I'm quite interested in the first afternoon session on day two, the trader's guide to survive in the modern FX market, because it struck me last week when I was looking at the shenanigans in the UK around the government sort of departures. I said in last week's podcast, price action was quite strange. You dropped 30 points and went up, and then went down again, and then went up. And there was all this confusion, and I think a lot of it is the impact of mean reversion strategies on markets. It could also be that some of the more traditional traders out there don't have access to Twitter, so they're waiting for the news to come out on their regular news service. It could also be that there's a real lack of traders outside the retail space. Someone said to me this week that actually the next generation of traders for hedge funds will not come from the banking industry the way it traditionally used to. It will come from the quant fields, this going back to the thing of a few weeks ago, the quantamentals that they're all looking for, or it will come from the retail space. Guys that actually have traded can prove their worth and build a track record for themselves. So I'm quite interested in that sort of panel eight on the second afternoon, because I think, going back to that cable move, cable has ended the week 300 points lower. So the fundamental move was in place. So any trader acting in a traditional manner would have made good money. But I'm interested in how many modern traders made money in that, because with the price action the way it was and a lot of the strategies that are out there, I'm not sure they did. So I think, that'll be my one. Although, as you say, I think they're all pretty good. It's, it's worth going for the whole 2 days. And the...
we do say so ourselves.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's it for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week with a discussion of what's going to happen this week, and we look forward to speaking to you then. Thanks very much.